The following contains graphic discussions of murder and sexual violence. Listener discretion is advised.
I cannot convey any better the traumatic words that you'd hear on this 911 tape. And when I hear them today, my blood runs cold.
3-year-old female child, unconscious, not breathing. He is wasting away a life in a jail for a murder he didn't commit, and worse, for his own daughter, with whom he loved.
There is a whole bunch of evidence now that links Masuk to the crime scene.
There is absolutely no evidence of any forced entry, any breaking in, and according to the defendant, the only people in that house with permission were himself and Christina.
This is Suspect Convictions with Scott Reeder. I'm Willis Kern. The greatest tool in exonerating the wrongly convicted during the past decade is DNA testing. And defense attorneys contend they have uncovered DNA evidence that points to Barton McNeil's innocence. But prosecutors are saying not so fast. The evidence may not be what it seems. We all remember learning about DNA in school.
DNA is the instruction manual for how to build life. From animals to plants to humans, it defines us all. Information is stored in DNA using four types of molecules, which come in pairs. We have billions of these pairs.
We also remember its role in the O.J. Simpson trial.
Does that mean that these characteristics that Mr. Simpson has, that are also found in the Bundy Walk bloodstain, are only found in approximately one out of 170 million Caucasians or African Americans?
Yes, approximately.
Despite DNA evidence that seemed to point toward guilt, a jury voted to acquit. On the other hand, it has often been used to obtain release for wrongly convicted inmates.
This is history. I became the first person in the United States to be freed by post-conviction DNA testing from a capital conviction, which was death row and double life. I received a full pardon from the governor. I received $300,000 from my trouble. But what puzzled me to burst was who killed Dawn Hamilton.
So, Scott, we hear this term when we talk about DNA in court cases, touch DNA. Exactly what is touch DNA?
It's interesting, Willis. I mean, when you or I or anyone touches a fabric or touches something, a few skin cells will drop away and embed themselves in the fabric. So that's kind of what touch DNA is. It's such a minute amount of genetic material there that up until recent years, it couldn't even be detected. Now, because of the advances in forensic science, they can detect those sort of things. And it's really fascinating because this was something, of course, they couldn't test for 20 years ago on the bed linens that Christina was on when she died. But they were able to test this last year for the presence of Masuk's DNA as well as Bart's and Christina's on those bed linens. And what they found was kind of interesting.
What role did DNA play in Bart's first trial, if any?
I don't know of any role that it played whatsoever. But you got to remember, 20 years ago, DNA testing was really in its infancy. Now, they did test some hairs that were found on the bed, and they were found to be Christina's, so they weren't particularly probative or exculpatory. In other words, they didn't either point towards innocence or guilt, because you'd expect Christina's hairs to be in her own bed. But now, the Illinois Innocence Project is saying they found Masuk's DNA. And this is what Gwen Jordan had to say about that. She's one of Bart's attorneys.
Since then, we have had so many advances in DNA testing, to the point now where we have what they call low copy or touch DNA. So we can have the bed sheet and the pillowcase and the other hairs that were found on the pillow on the bed where Christina was murdered. We can have those tested now through more advanced DNA testing. And those results indicate that Masuk Nolan was all over the bed sheet, the pillowcase, and her hairs were on the pillow where Christina was found dead.
Martin McNeil says Masuk had not been allowed in the apartment during the final week of Christina's life and that the sheets were laundered before Christina slept on them that night. So he contends there is no reason why her DNA should have been found on the bed linens.
The lab technician that did the original testing of the sheet, you know, took the evidence, they brought it in, and there were urine stains and some blood stains on the sheet. So the lab technician did a complete analysis of the sheet and wrote on the piece of paper that she of her report that the sheet looked clean and smelled clean, but for these stains. In addition to that, of course, Bart told the police detectives that he had just picked up the sheets from the laundry that day and had, in fact, and has put into evidence the check for the laundromat for that day when he picked up the laundry.
But McLean County prosecutors say this evidence is far from a slam dunk for exoneration. Here's Mary Cole with the McLean County State's Attorney's Office.
How the defense attorneys have phrased that to us is, quote, the DNA testing places Masuk on the bed of the crime scene the night of the murder. Well, that's not an accurate statement, because we're talking about Bart and Masuk, who were in a long-term dating relationship, and according to Bart himself, he had had sexual contact with Masuk as recently as June 13th. So it's certainly reasonable that Masuk's DNA would still be in the residence.
Well, Scott, DNA is supposed to make things so black and white, but it doesn't really seem to be seems to be muddying up the situation here a little bit. What do you make out of what we just heard?
I didn't realize this until I started doing work on this in podcasts, but there are different types of DNA evidence. For example, let's say I had a cut on my hand, Willis, and I were to shake your hand, and some of the blood were to come off on your palm, and then you were to shake somebody else's hand, maybe a little bit of that blood would transfer over to that person. So in those kind of situations, this DNA can't be transferred around. If you have a medium like blood or hair or semen or other bodily fluids, DNA can be transferred from person to person. Touch DNA, I'm told, operates a lot differently because you're dealing with such minute amounts of DNA, you know, like just a few skin cells that got released when you were handling fabric. For example, Willis, if you were to touch the sleeve of my shirt right now, and I were to go home and my wife were to pick up my shirt, your DNA would not rub off on my wife. It would remain embedded in the shirt. That's just the kind of way it interacts with the environment.
So in essence, it sounds like what you're saying, Scott, is that the more robust the sample, the greater the reliability.
Maybe another way I would put it about it would be, if you have a medium like bodily fluids or hair or something like that, that's easily transferable, it moves around. But if you have something like a handful of skin cells to get left behind, they don't really move around the same way. They tend to be static. A lot hinges on whether these sheets were laundered or not laundered. But one of the things that ran through my mind is, okay, Bart dated this woman on and off for 3 years. This is his bed. Let's say he did put fresh sheets on that day on that mattress that he and Masuk had been on many times. Wouldn't you expect to find Masuk's DNA on that fresh sheet? It's on the mattress, I would assume, so why wouldn't it just migrate onto the sheets? And I asked that question of a guy who's a world-renowned expert on forensic DNA. His name's Lawrence Kobolinski. He's at John Jay College in New York. He's trained many New York City police officers and others. He's tends to work with the prosecution and law enforcement more than with defense attorneys. But I asked him that question. Could this explain why Masuk's DNA was found on the sheets? And this is what he had to say.
Where somebody came into contact with that mattress, you wouldn't find DNA on top of the lint. In other words, you would need a direct contact in order to have a transfer of cells from skin onto the object. So they're not going to migrate through the fabric to end up on the other side of the linen.
Kobolinski says normal laundering with detergent would destroy any DNA on a bed sheet.
Laundering generally will, if it's done right, it will generally clean the garment fairly well. I'm not saying there aren't going to be, you know, micro traces of something left behind, But generally, if it goes through that process, you know, I suspect it'll be pretty much clean of DNA.
So with the presence of touch DNA on the sheet, much hinges on when the sheets were last laundered. A technician at the Illinois State Police Crime Lab in Morton, Illinois, noted on her report that the sheets smelled clean. Barton McNeil says he had the bed linens washed before Christina stayed with him that night, and he has presented a receipt from a laundromat showing when he picked up his laundry. But Assistant State Attorney Mary Cole says this hardly is definitive evidence.
He has said through his attorneys that he has proof that he had taken these sheets to the laundromat, and he has produced some type of document. I can't remember if it's a credit card statement or something showing there was a payment to a laundromat, but it's not an itemized bill. So there is no evidence that this sheet was washed.
Such arguments don't sit well with Vanessa Potkin, an attorney specializing in DNA cases for the National Innocence Project, which is not involved in this case.
Somebody else's DNA on sheets, and it really shouldn't be there. I mean, that should be a huge red flag for the state. Instead of doing mental gymnastics to come up with reasons why the laundry couldn't have been washed or there could have been some contamination or mixture, take a step back and say, is this reasonable? Why is this person's DNA on the sheet so next to this young child who was smothered?
But Mary Cole remains skeptical.
My dog died last spring, and right now I have hairs of my dog on my dress. I can see them, and I've certainly washed this many times since last spring. So, I mean, that's just common sense, and that's something that the fact finder, either the judge or the jury, is supposed to employ when they're looking at the evidence. They're supposed to apply their common sense. And I wish that we could have a common sense dialogue about all of this. But if it's going to be phrased as if that hair or the mixtured stain is a smoking gun, then we can't have a reasonable dialogue, because that's simply not the case.
So, Scott, we have some pretty diverse opinions there about how this DNA evidence is viewed. Of course, on the defense side, they're saying that this is a huge red flag, and the prosecutors are saying not so fast. So where are we with this now?
You know, I think we're talking about different things. When I talk to the prosecutors, they talk about the hair and why the hair would be there, and how it's not, you know, you could throw a load of laundry in and hair from one person to another could bounce around, and it's not particularly surprising that you'd find Masuk's hair on the sheets, which I agree with, but that doesn't explain the touch DNA of Masuk on the sheets themselves. If it doesn't transfer over, and if DNA is usually destroyed in the laundering process, that really begs the question of, A, when did the sheets get laundered? If, let's say they've been on that bed for a couple weeks, and Masuk had been on that bed, then it would make sense that her DNA was there. But let's say the answer is that Bart's telling the truth, and he had just put fresh sheets on that bed that day, and Masuk's DNA shows up on that. That's a whole different story. I mean, then you have to ask yourself, how on earth did that DNA get there?
So who do you think does the better job of backing up their case? Because we do have two diverse views of this. The prosecution or the defense do a better job, do you think?
I don't know. Here's what I do know. It's very, very difficult to overturn a conviction. The guy is presumed to be guilty, and they have to show new evidence that would indicate that the jury would have come up to a different conclusion. In this particular case, the judge would have come to a different conclusion. Or they have to be able to show grievous mistakes that were made in the first trial, or something like this. I don't know. When I look at this, I'm thinking, I don't know if this makes it to the threshold or not of compelling enough new evidence to point towards a reason to overturn this conviction. But, you know, just because Bart is presumed guilty does not mean that there's no hope for him in getting released. Vanessa Potkin, an attorney for the Innocence Project, had a pretty good explanation of that, in fact.
One somebody's convicted, it is true, the burden shifts. Now it's the convicted person's burden to show that they have evidence that is significant enough that it would lead a jury to come to a different verdict. And it's very difficult. Once somebody is convicted, it's extraordinarily difficult to overturn a conviction of somebody who's completely innocent and should have never been convicted in the first place. It's just that the system is stacked against the innocent person after conviction. But that said, there are the burden that a convicted person has to meet to establish their innocence. You know, you don't have to show that it's impossible that you committed the crime. That type of proof almost never exists, and that's not the legal standard. The legal standard is, if a jury heard this evidence, would they probably come to a different verdict?
Potkin says prosecutors likely fear a new trial because it would be more difficult to obtain a conviction because the alternate suspect from the first trial has gone on to murder someone else.
A prosecutor's job is to see that justice is done and not just obtain a conviction. So it shouldn't cause the prosecutors any alarm. They should embrace trying to get to the truth of the case because that really is their constitutional obligation. But if you view your job as one to uphold a conviction at all costs, that would probably be very intimidating and the last thing that you would want to have happen.
But Mary Cole of the prosecution says neither she nor her boss, Jason Chambers, would ever condone prosecuting a case in which they personally believed there was a reasonable doubt of guilt.
We have ethical duties to never proceed on a case where we personally have a reasonable doubt about guilt. So I, of course, believe every single person that I've prosecuted is guilty. But there is always a human element, and I know that there have been convictions that have been overturned. And I know in this office, I mean, I know on cases I've worked in this office, that if I develop a reasonable doubt, my bosses are 100% in support of erring on the side of caution when it comes to incarcerating an innocent person.
And Mary Cole adds that she believes Barton McNeil is guilty. Veteran defense attorney Vanessa Potkin, on the other hand, often finds herself viewing such prosecutorial claims with a jaundiced eye.
I wish that I could say that this is a very unique circumstance, and unfortunately it isn't. We're litigating cases right now where we found DNA on critical pieces of evidence at the crime scene, and through the code of state bank, they're linked to somebody else who committed a similar crime. And that's exactly the type of case that a prosecutor should walk into court and be willing to join in a motion to vacate the conviction. And unfortunately, sometimes, based on the case, based on the jurisdiction, prosecutors just dig in their heels. And even in the face of science, want to cling to lesser types of reliable evidence.
So, Scott, I ask you again, does it sound like the Innocence Project is set up where they need to be in order to proceed with motions to either free Bart from prison or grant him a new trial?
It depends on who you ask. Some folks are saying this new DNA evidence is a really compelling, and it would indicate that Bart should at least get a new trial. And let's say they do get a new trial. It's going to be a tough sell to a jury, I think, that he's guilty beyond a reasonable doubt when they present the alternate suspect, Masuk, as somebody who went on to kill somebody else. I mean, people are going to wonder about that. But on the other hand, you're talking about minute traces of DNA. Is it convincing that Bart got the bed linens laundered right before Christina came over? I mean, it's basically a he said, she said sort of situation. I mean, I don't know how you prove something beyond a reasonable doubt that it happened. I mean, he's saying, yeah, I went over to the laundromat and I picked up the laundry. Here's the receipt for it. And I brought it home and put the sheets on the bed. The prosecution saying is, well, yeah, you got a receipt from the laundromat, but maybe you just had your shirts and pants done and nothing else. It's a tough one. We're told to use the word common sense here. Is it common sense that if you were going to have your daughter over at your house that you'd make sure that she was sleeping on clean sheets? Well, if it was one of my daughters, yeah, I would do that. But I can't speak for how Bart would have interacted with his daughter 20-some years ago. For some people, that's a really important thing. Other people, not so much.
So if you're going to rate the level of importance DNA evidence plays in any new trial or a possible exoneration of Bart McNeil. On a scale of 1 to 10, where would you put the DNA evidence, Scott?
Probably 7. I think that it is interesting at the very least. Is it compelling? I'm not so sure. But it's interesting that they have this new evidence and they're going to be presenting it. And it'll be interesting to see how, when this gets presented before a judge here in McLean County, how that particular judge deals with this new evidence. If he views it as compelling or if he just views it as, you know, somewhat interesting. You really have to show is that there's a high probability that the jury would have come up with a different verdict if they'd only had this evidence. And I don't know the answer to that.
And, of course, another key factor is we're still waiting on the Illinois Innocence Project to file motions in this case, something they've been studying for several years now, but they still have yet to make that leap to actually file a claim in court, right?
Yeah, I talked to Bart, and he's getting very impatient with his lawyers wanting something filed right away. I talked to one of the attorneys, and he said, you know, we want to make sure this is everything we do is absolutely right and compelling and makes a good case for Bart. And we're not going to get rushed in this process. We're going to make sure that everything is done in the appropriate manner.
Next week during Suspect Convictions, we're back with another roundtable. Scott, this one including a professor and a podcaster. Tell us about it.
Well, we have an interesting couple. We have Amanda Vickery, who is a psychology professor at Illinois Wesleyan University, and probably the ultimate true crime buff. And she's going to be looking at the case. And there's a lot of psychological elements to consider in this case. Is there one of these people that's implicated, a psychopath? You know, what motivates people to be in certain relationships? What's going on? That sort of thing. So she adds a really fresh perspective into the mix. And we also have Carrie Martin from White Wine True Crime, also a big true crime buff, taking a look and discussing the evidence presented in the Barton McNeil case. It's really good to have both of them on Suspect Convictions, to be honest with you, Willis.
That's next week during Suspect Convictions. Special thanks to Colin Thompson, WGLT General Manager R.C. McBride, and the production staff of Sound Ideas, including Mike McCurdy, Charlie Schlenker, and Ryan Denham. With investigative journalist and Suspect Convictions creator Scott Reeder, I'm Willis Kern. We'll see you next week on Suspect Convictions.